Across Divides is a podcast that discusses challenges faced by communities around the island of Ireland. In this season, we're taking a deep dive into Carlingford Lough and the Shifting Tides Project, connecting coastal communities between the shores of Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. We speak with scientists, artists, and communities about the different ways they understand the sea, exploring creative approaches to protect it. Learn more at theshiftingtides.org.
One Monday morning, I was sitting at the old table in our kitchen at home in Restrever when there was a knock on the door. That's the table I'm knocking. But I went to the door, opened it. There was a man with about five cameras hanging around his neck. He said, "Would you be Colm Sands?" And I said, "I am. I would be indeed." And he says, "I've come to take a photograph of the invisible tree. I believe you could show me where it is." "I'd be glad to," says I. And a few minutes later, we were walking up into one of Ireland's last remaining ancient woodlands, Restrever Oakwood, to see the invisible tree up there above the shores of Carlingford Lough. I'm very lucky to live in this place. It's an area of great beauty, no matter what side of the lough you're on, or if you're slightly above it, as we were when we walked up the invisible tree.
Colm Sands is a musician and activist from Rostrever, a small town on the north side of Carlingford Lough. The hills above Rostrever roll into the Mourne Mountains. Rivers run from their heights into the sea that flows and ebbs on the tide against the shore. The hills are covered with a thick forest, pine plantations and ancient woodland that have inspired wondrous stories and songs and are a home for countless non-human critters. When these trees were threatened, Colm set out to celebrate and protect them. To protect something, we need first to know it. And to know it, we need to see it. This episode of Across Divides is about making the invisible visible.
What else is nature if it's not our life support? The environment is such a kind of empty word, I think, but it's everything that's around us, that it should be celebrated. You know, it's not something to be mournfully protected. It's so beautiful, so special, so totally important to us all that it seems very, very important to work night and day to look after it and to celebrate it and laugh about it and enjoy it and laugh about the people that laugh at ourselves for taking ourselves so seriously, laugh at the people who pretend they can't see trees. I mean, it's entertainment. Why not enjoy it as well, you know?
When an inner city style development was proposed for Rostrever, consultants were brought in to survey an area that came right up against woodland in Kilbroney Forest Park. Their report failed to recognize 8 oak trees, and a group of local people decided to get together and put them firmly back on the map.
I think what really triggered it for me, getting with other people together to get a movement going, was the tree consultant who came and drew up a report from which he managed to airbrush the existence of 8 oak trees, the ones closest to the proposed development. And I remember looking at that report and thinking, okay, this man has 40 years of experience working with broadleaf trees. He's got to be able to recognize an oak tree. And how can he miss out 8 trees? And why would it be the ones closest to the development? But nevertheless, there's that thing about the written word and the professional signature. You look at the report, he's saying the tree isn't there. I can see it. But maybe I'm wrong, you know, because humans do that. We have so much respect for the written word, you know, in the beginning was the word and all that. I started to invite people to come up and just ask local people to come up and say, "Can you see a tree here?" Yeah, I made little videos with people touching the tree and saying, "Yeah, this is an oak tree. I can see it, feel it." But that idea, I think, of asking people to bear witness to something so important that can support hundreds, if not thousands, of kinds of life.
The Invisible Tree gained such popularity that it has received 250,000 views on Google Maps. It even won the Woodland Trust Tree of the Year Award in 2019. The creativity the column and the other residents of Ross Trevor employed was a powerful force that raised the profile of the Invisible Tree and threw a process of legalities and technicalities into confusion.
What we're talking about really is a surreal world. You're bridging this world between reality and fantasy. Ireland is so rich in fairy stories and phantoms and spirits, but here is this world of men, usually in suits, you know, who see things that aren't there and who don't see things that are there. And one of the actions, you know, that we're often using creative ways of telling the story, because if you go into a council chamber or a high court, there is a special language in use there. It's often quite cryptic, deliberately confusing. But these people are very expert, I suppose, in just brushing aside arguments. But they're not so good at handling satire and irony, which are really powerful forces, you know, as creative people have long recognized. And the original meaning of irony, it is basically feigned ignorance, you know, pretending you know what's going on, but you pretend you don't know, which is exactly what's happening there with the tree. This tree consultant sees the tree. He knows it will be bad news for the developer, so he pretends he doesn't see it.
A few years later, just down the road in Warren Point, a foul smell rose up out of the harbour. Once again, residents confronted the council, but had their concerns dismissed.
People were complaining about it. One councillor received, I think it was 56 complaints in one day about the smell that was pervading the town, the smell of rotting waste. But the people who give the license for that waste, the Northern Ireland Environment Authority, or agency maybe it is, I've forgotten now, they sent out sniffers, the kind of consultants, not dogs, people who would come to sniff and see if there was a smell. And of course, like the tree, they couldn't smell what everyone else was smelling, just as the tree consultant couldn't see what everyone else could see. So I think we have to take the entertainment out of this that's there. I mean, this is basic, the most primal, primitive comedy you get in a pantomime. Someone pretends they can't see something, the audience shout, "It's behind you, he's behind you," whatever it is, and they get a great laugh out of this. So I think we should enjoy the entertainment, the comedic element of people who are prepared to make fools of themselves by pretending they can't see, smell, or whatever it is, something. And I just love working with people around the shores of this loch, and indeed around the shores of this island, and trying to just bring about the sanity of taking care of this system that supports all life.
Column stories highlight the ways in which local knowledge and experience can be dismissed at times by those in authority, but how creativity and community are powerful forces for enacting change around the very real problems encountered by folks who live in direct relation with the natural world around them, whether that be on the land or in the sea. The underwater world is often out of sight. It's beyond the sorts of references we are so familiar with. Trees, mountains, rivers. On a still day, the waters of Carlingford Loch reflect the sky with a bright sheen. What lies beneath it remains in relative mystery.
So you're walking along the beach and you look out to sea and you see, in this part of the world anyway, grey seas under a grey sky. And it doesn't really reveal much, if anything, about what lies beneath.
Dave Wall is the citizen science officer for the National Biodiversity Data Centre. He describes how paying attention to what lies on the shore can give an indication of the lives being lived beneath it.
You do get a glimpse. You might see kelp sticking up above the surface of the water, which gives you an indication that it's not just water. There's stuff growing under there. And what you do is you walk along the shore and you look for what's cast ashore from the sea. So you get a mixture of species there. Most of what you will get are species that occur just off the shore under the water. These are bivalves like mussels and other species like that. Some of the crab species that aren't intertidal but live all their lives beneath the waves. A lot of the seaweed species that you find subtidally. You will also get, though, ocean drifters. You'll get pelagic species that may have come from nearby or may have come from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean.
When we find creatures on the shore, they're usually independent specimens. It takes either a creative leap or a bit of thoughtful research to build up a picture of what's going on underwater, to imagine and understand the intricate networks of marine habitats from which these individual specimens have come.
It's a humongous mix and mush and mash of colours and shapes and species and forms. If you don't like water or you don't scuba dive, then you can still find out a lot about marine ecosystems by looking at what's on the shore.
As part of his work with the National Biodiversity Data Centre, Dave runs the Explore Your Shore program, where participants can make observations that become part of research into trends and patterns on the shore and the sea. Anyone can take part, and the results feed into scientific research that shows how the environment is changing, both in the long term and the short. We might not think of the sea as seasonal, apart from getting cold and wavy in the winter, but Dave explains that careful observation reveals all sorts of changes throughout the year.
Often people look at the shore and they'll just go, hey, it's covered in seaweed all year, isn't it? Well, it is, but the mixture of sea species on the shore will change over the course of the seasons, much as it does in terrestrial habitats. You will find more of particular types of seaweed at different times of year. Some seaweeds flourish in the winter, while others flourish in the summer. And that is something that can be influenced by factors in the ocean. And those factors can include human-induced factors such as climate change. In some cases, what we see is species undergoing expansion. They're moving northward around the coastline. This is what we might expect. Ireland lies on a biogeographic boundary. We have cold temperate water to the north. We have warm temperate water to the south. So we would expect to see species that like warm water expanding northwards, and at the same time, species that prefer cold water retreating northwards. So everything is moving northward. So we see species, a good example might be the toothed topshell, which is a big topshell species, and it's kind of a warmer water-loving species. And we see its distribution during the last major kind of intertidal survey in the mid-1990s was restricted to the west coast and the south coast. Today, we see its distribution runs all the way up the east coast and further around the north coast as well. So there's a species that's potentially expanded its range due to more favorable conditions because of climate change.
Some species can act as bioindicators for climate change, meaning that their numbers and distribution are affected by warming oceans. When sets of data from the past can be compared with the present day, it's possible to determine how species and their wider ecosystems are being affected by climate change. By recognizing patterns, we can see that some species are emerging earlier than they did before, while others are moving further north. But in marine environments, where there hasn't been as much research as in terrestrial spaces, there is often a lack of data to make firm deductions.
We have a problem in the marine sphere in that we lack the baselines, or in many cases, we lack good baseline data for these species.
Shifting baselines is a phrase that describes how our own experience of an environment is what we accept as normality. It means that changes we see in our own lifetimes are measured against our own memories, not taking into account what happened before. The consequence with shifting baselines is that changes can be normalized over time, so we don't notice what we are losing and it slips quietly away.
If you go and talk to your father or your mother or your grandfather or your grandmother, or if they're still knocking around, your great-grandmother or your great-grandfather, and they share their stories of their shore with you or the sea with you, you'll get a very different impression of what was there. These stories, and you know, in a lot of cases, they are stories because scientific recording wasn't maybe as dedicated as it is now, and we don't have the precise data, but certainly we can tell from stories and from written accounts into the past just how different life was, how richer the biodiversity was, especially the biomass, how much more of everything there used to be in the sea.
Stories are powerful modes of communication that aren't always granted legitimacy when compared with rigorous scientific study, but they often contain insights to the past that alter the way we might think about the environments in which we live.
I have a book sitting on my shelf, a book called Catch 'em While You Can, Sea Fishing Off the Northern Irish Coast by Larry Nixon. I have no idea who Larry Nixon was, but he wrote a book describing his sea fishing experiences in the 1970s around the Northern Irish coastline. And in Carlingford Lough, he describes catching common skate. And he also describes the sheer number of species that you used to be able to catch in the Lough. Indeed, there used to be, I believe, a Guinness-sponsored sea fishing festival, if you like, in the Lough back in the day, in the 70s and 60s. And of course, in those days, there were kind of derby fisheries. So you went out and you caught as much as you could and you landed it and you weighed it. And the fella who won the prize was the one with the most weight of fish. Now, after that, all the fish were dumped in a skip and dumped in a landfill or otherwise disposed of. So over time, we have tended to lose richness in biodiversity. We have tended to lose the sheer biomass, the amount of life that was in our seas. There's bits around the Lough still today where you find fragments of oyster reef. But if you go back into the historical descriptions back in the 1800s of the oyster beds within Carlingford Lough, they were something like half a mile wide and 2 miles long. That's the kind of reef habitat you were talking about back then. There's only fragments of that left now.
The oyster reefs Dave is referring to here are native oysters, rather than the commercial Pacific oysters that are farmed all around Carlingford Lough. In the past, native oyster reefs grew all along our coasts, supporting a diversity of life in the way the coral reefs do in the tropics. But over-harvesting, trawling, and disease have reduced this once magnificent habitat, so it no longer registers in our consciousness of the sea. Part of Dave's hope with the Explore Your Shore program is that it builds up a solid foundation of scientific data so that baselines are established for future research, and he wants that process to be as accessible as possible.
By getting involved in system science today, what you can do is you can take your small number of records, contribute it to a much bigger data set where everyone chips in their little bit of knowledge to form a greater body of knowledge, and we get a map or we get a description of where these species are found today, what their relative abundance is, or certainly relative richness of species around the coastline, when they occur. That gives us a good impression of what things are like today, so that in 20 more years' time, when I'm hopefully retired with my slippers on and doing very little, the next person along will be able to collect another data set of coastal species and compare it to 20 years ago and see how things have changed.
Stories have the capacity to influence how we live in the world, and they have often been our best way of understanding what's going on around us. They are rooted in our deepest experiences and our interactions with the land and the sea and each other. They are passed through generations and carry subtle meanings amongst captivating narratives, whether in the shade of an oak forest or the depths of the seas. A bit of storytelling has the ability to make the invisible visible.
This is from 1966. Archaeological Survey of South Down, and they went back right to Neolithic people, and when it was thought that when first people came here, this is a little poem that somebody called John O'Donovan wrote about the people who lived in the shores of Carlingford Lough and Strangford Lough. They found no evidence really of farming. They said that the people of Ulster were savages and had neither bread nor herds nor flocks, but lives by scraping limpets off the rocks. So there was enough in the locks for them to survive without worrying about having to plow fields or anything. So we're talking about baselines, and that's what I'm interested in prehistory nearly. My research has been in the field of the times of St. Brona, and people could have lived off the loch because the loch was teeming with fish and birds, seabirds, even sea eagles, and the food was there for them. So that's what's in my head.
Susan Farrell is an artist and writer living in Ross Trevor. She swims in the sea all year round, and her observations show the value of personal stories in understanding the history of marine life, shifting baselines and possibilities for restoring undersea environments.
I like how you say that you're observing because you're an artist. It's usually the viewpoints of scientists that are taken into consideration in these sorts of things. But the fact that artists have that knack for noticing. I think science can be really sort of narrowed down, looking one specific thing really, really carefully. Whereas I feel like artists have a bit more of an all-round awareness and then notice other things going on in the periphery as well.
We went down to swim one day and there was all these sand eels now on the shore, and they'd just come in a huge swarm, and the mackerel had cornered them right up as close as they could get them into the shore, and then they all started to hop out. So we seen that this swarm of sand eels coming in and the mackerel coming behind them. Haven't seen that again. The shows of sand eels when I was 11 were like the size of cars or lorries, and now they're like tiny shows. They're like the size of footballs. So whilst you see them coming back, they're still very, very badly diminished.
That's exactly what shifting baselines are, I suppose. In the way you saw what it was like maybe 30 years ago, and your image of what you'd like it to be is that image.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. My husband grew up here and he was able to catch trout that were 6 feet long, witness elvers coming up the Ferry Glen River, shining in the moonlight, creating a light of their own because there were so many of them scrambling over the locks. Yeah, I'm thinking, well, where is your baseline? Where do we want to get it back to? We can't get it back to early Christian times. Because then you'd have to bring wolves back as well. There's wolves in the forest here. I don't think that's going to happen. But just even in my lifetime, I would like to know that Carnforth Loch now is a breeding ground for trout. And there are big shows of sand eels, and the mackerel are chasing them in.
Things become invisible when they are forgotten, lost to time, dropped from memory and vanished from the stories we tell. That doesn't always mean they aren't still living, just beneath the surface, surviving and even thriving out of sight. It's incredible what a little bit of curiosity can reveal. Throughout this series, we will continue to look at some of the marvelous discoveries that have been made by communities, scientists, and artists on the shores of Carlingford Loch. We're going to search beneath the sea for hidden life, marvel at it, explore ways to protect it, and in the process, enrich the lives of the people who engage with it. The intro and outro music for this podcast are from the Mind Orchestra and the Library of Congress Archive. The mysterious transitions are drawn from Karen Power's composition, Hidden Life of Carlingford Loch. You can hear the full piece in the Soundwaves episode in this series, along with conversations on citizen science, rewilding our seas, stories of smuggling and seaweed foraging. Throughout the series, we also gain insights on creative approaches to community-led marine conservation and hold challenging conversations about balancing coastal livelihoods with protecting our seas. To get involved with Shifting Tides and access a wealth of online resources, visit theshiftingtides.org. Shifting Tides is a recipient of the Creative Climate Action Fund, an initiative from the Creative Ireland Programme. It is funded by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media in collaboration with the Department of the Taoiseach. The fund supports creative, cultural and artistic projects that build awareness around climate change and empower citizens to make meaningful behavioural transformations. Shifting Tides is a project under the umbrella of the Wheel and NICFA's iCommunity program, supported by the DFA, the Shared Island Civic Society Fund. iCommunity seeks to support the community and voluntary sector on the island of Ireland, working together on common issues such as community-led climate action. You can find out more at iCommunityHub.org. Thank you for listening.